Hey, let's get lost together. Maybe we'll talk about how you did stuff.
That doesn't quite work.
Hey, man, what's going on? What are you working on?
Just riffing on something.
That sounds cool. Like it could be a theme song or something. Hey, what's the deal with your doorman? That guy really doesn't like me, does he?
It takes him a while to warm up to people. Anyway, what's up?
Not a lot. Just came down to work on the next episode of my podcast. I need a new show intro, actually. Some sort of thing with a big rock voice and lots of production.
Welcome to the Lost Together podcast with Matt Wardlaw.
Something like that?
Whoa, exactly like that. How'd you do that?
I'm not sure. One of the buttons on the board here is kind of dusty. I think it's malfunctioning.
Well, I guess I'm going to go get to work on the podcast. Do you want to sit in?
Well, maybe. Who are you talking to?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me check the schedule. Hey, where are you going? Huh. Well, I guess he's gone. Let's see who we've got on the show this week.
Loading this week's guest information.
This week, our guest is Dan Baird. Dan has certainly taken plenty of my money over the years. Albums, cassettes, CDs, concert tickets, DVDs, t-shirts, you name it, I've bought it. For a lot of folks, Dan comes onto their radar in the 80s as a member of the Atlanta rock and roll band Georgia Satellites. He was the frontman and one of the principal songwriters in the group. They scored plenty of airplay on rock radio with songs like Battleship Chains, Open All Night, and of course, Keep Your Hands to Yourself. Dan was with the Satellites for three records between 1986 and 1989 before moving on to begin a successful solo career, which began officially in 1992 with the release of his solo debut, Love Songs for the Hearing Impaired. He's made a good stack of records since then, including releases with the Yahoos, the Bluefields, and his current project, Dan Baird and Homemade Sin, a dangerously rockin' musical collective that features Dan paired with Jason and the Scorchers guitarist Warner E. Hodges, former Satellites drummer Mauro Magellan, and bassist Mick Nielsen. Dan and the Sin recently released their third studio album, Get Loud, and they're in the midst right now of a rare set of U.S. headlining shows to support the new record. We spoke with Dan to talk about that new album and a whole bunch of other things, including his memorable experience working with legendary Rolling Stones saxophonist Bobby Keys, who he toured with for a few years as a member of Bobby Keys and the Suffering Bastards, a gig which found him singing an amazing catalog of hits that we all know and love. And we're not just talking Rolling Stones records. We're also talking about songs by Dion, George Harrison, John Lennon, and more. Dan gives us some really interesting backstory on that whole gig. You can connect with Dan and the Homemade Sin via their website at danbairdandhomemadesin.net, and they're on Facebook as well. Feel free to email us at losttogetherpod@gmail.com and visit us online at losttogetherpod.com, where you can subscribe to the podcast via RSS and iTunes. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Lost Together Pod. Please give us a follow, a like, and all of that good stuff. We appreciate it. Thanks, as always, for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's interview. It's been a few years since you've been in Cleveland for a proper, you know, Dan Baird show or whatever. But I kind of wanted to... I wanted to start off by talking about the last time you were here in town, which was 2012 at the Beachland with Bobby Keys and the Suffering Bastards. And I would have to imagine...
Right.
I would have to imagine that right on the surface there, I mean, touring with Bobby, that had to be a colorful experience.
My God. It is... He seriously was Yosemite Sam that could play the shit out of a saxophone. He was, you know, the madder and or more inebriated he got, the more Texas he got.
Yeah.
And, it was periodically quite the source of humor. God damn it, I'm going to bust rural on your ass if you don't cut that guy, you know. And that's not an exaggeration.
No.
He was just, you know, he was Texas-sized.
Well, it really was an amazing evening of music, and I think obviously a lot of people associate Bobby with the Stones, but I mean, that was a set list that reminds you how many amazing records he had been associated with across the years.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then we didn't do any Nielsen songs.
Yeah.
We didn't do Photograph by Ringo. There was a batch of tunes that we could have done, but for whatever reason, the lineup, trying to keep that lineup, you know, together for a week without anybody working, you know, because he's poached from all working bands.
Yep.
You know, so it's like, you know, trying to get enough guys to cover well enough. I mean, they did some shows without me. They did some shows about, you know, Mike Webb. Everybody was replaceable in that, but Bobby, I mean, it's just, you know, that was my set list when I was in my first band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you know, seriously, Live With Me. It was like, I'm going like, I don't need a lyric sheet. It's in the DNA. Same thing with the letter. You know, it's like we used to do those when I was a kid. So it was like to have the right sound come out was just freaking amazing.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about how that whole thing came together and how you got involved? Because, I mean, as I'm aware, it started...
I'll tell you, Bobby had put together... He was living here in town.
Yeah.
And had befriended the guitarist, Chark Kinsolving. That's spelled C-H-A-R-K. K-I-N-S-O-L-V-I-N-G. Okay, that's all you get from me.
Nice.
Chark had begun to put together a band, and Mike Webb, the keyboard player, was working with him, and he had used a bunch of his old friends from up Kentucky. And they really didn't ring Bobby's bell. And he said, man, we need some, you know, Bobby told Chark, you know, we need some better guys. And so Chark just went, okay, fuck it. I'll call up Baird. I'll call up Gorman. I'll call up Robert. And it's just kind of like, let's just see what the hell happens. And we all went, playing with Bobby Keys? Yeah. Everybody had the same exact reaction.
Oh, yeah.
And then we went down and did a rehearsal at a club, Douglas Corner. And I can remember, I will tell you the story. We're in there, and, you know, Bobby's, you know, called up. He's going to be running a few minutes late, you know. Well, let's delve into some of this stuff, guys. And so, you know, we ran Live With Me, I think, and, you know, familiarize ourselves. And I think, you know, like the second or third song we did was The Letter. And he came in right at the top, and you know, his horn was still in his case and stuff, and he gave the finger, keep going. And he got his horn put together in time, you know, and walked up and blasted that solo. And it was just like, oh, my God, the sound. It's the sound. It's not like the sound. It's the sound. And it was completely amazing. We did The Wanderer right after that, and it was like, I'm 62 years old. I was 6 years old when the song came out. Bobby was 16 when he played on it. It's still one of the time-stopping moments of my life. It is just like, oh, my God, there it is. We all decided that, you know, we would do this as long as we could. And, you know, to find two or three guys that could be our backups if we had to go be working. And so he had... somewhat revolving, but that was the core for the first couple of years. Then Gorman got busy with Trigger Hippie and something else, his radio show.
Yep.
And so we got Brad Pemberton that played with Ryan Adams to come play. And it was like, we all agreed that Gorman may be a more powerful drummer, but Brad is a more right drummer.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like, you know, Gorman did, you know, on the tribute show, Gorman came in and played, you know, it was like, fucking love Steve, but it was just like, for whatever reason, it was just like Brad just had that bit of Charlie Watts in him.
Oh, yeah.
So it had the swing. But, you know... either guy was, you know, you're talking about degrees of greatness. And, you know, but it's kind of like, you know, the set list demanded that we have guys. And, you know, Chark was really, really great at doing Mick Taylor, you know. So it was, you know, me, it was kind of like, and I asked him, I said, don't you want a better singer? And he went, hell no, man. I get some guy in there singing off key, my horn's going to sound flat. Because he said, you know, I sang like he played flat. So we agreed it was a good thing.
Yeah, I kind of wondered about that because, I mean, as you said, the material, it's in your DNA, you grew up with it. But, I mean, I wondered if it was kind of a challenging spread of songs to attack, you know, over the course of a whole set list.
If you don't get too precious with it, if you don't get too freaked out by it, it's just great songs.
Yeah.
It's just great songs. Now, my favorites were the two instrumentals where I just got to be the, you know, rhythm guitar player.
Uh-huh.
You know, those will always be my favorites. You know, I love instrumentals. I'm the reluctant singer. You know, it's like, yeah, I can remember the words. I can come close enough to not embarrassing us pitch-wise. All right, I'll do it. You know, I'd rather play guitar. But if you're using all that oxygen to do that, you're not going to play great solos. I don't know how people like Hendrix and Stevie Ray would, you know, like, sing and then play a great solo. I just don't know how they do it. I don't have enough oxygen in my brain.
At that time, was there the thought that you guys would take this thing out on the road, or was it just something that everybody was having
fun? We did take it. There was always threats of, but Bobby, at that point in time, it was difficult for him to ride those long distances.
Uh-huh.
It really took it out of him.
Hmm.
And if he was going to fly, he did not want to fly in coach. So the monetary end of things ended up being not, it just didn't wash right.
Yeah.
I mean, we did a tour of Australia when Jagger's girlfriend committed suicide. We were supposed to be in and around Stones dates, but you know, we went down there anyway. That's War and Peace. That's not a story.
Yeah.
It's too much. But anyway, yeah, we did that. And it's, you know, Bobby had already turned the corner on his health at that point. He had started to, the erosion was starting to show. I mean, he died of liver failure. Then again, he took that liver out behind the back and just whooped it hard. You know, it was not the child's portion that he did. But he was already, he'd have good days or bad days depending on how his ammonia levels were. We didn't know it at the time, but he'd already started turning an ashy kind of color. It was just, you know, and he held on for another 6 months.
Well, I know when that show got announced here in Cleveland, I was really excited because I was like, oh, man, I think this is that thing that he's been doing in Nashville, so I think Dan's going to be part of this. And sure enough, you know, there was the whole band. So I feel really fortunate that we got one of those shows, you know, here in Cleveland.
They were, and I think you guys were on the way back home from Toronto. You were the way back home. And that's when he had really started hitting stride.
Yeah, it was a great night.
Oh, man. And, you know, and he's, you know, he was, the only thing that was weird to him was to be standing front and center. And it's just like, there's a whole lot of racket up there, ain't there, Bobby? It's kind of like, welcome to singer land.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, there's just nothing but racket in the front and center of the stage. And he'd always been, you know, a wingman. And it's a lot more controllable out there.
Mm-hmm.
You get in front and center and it's just kind of like, well, there's the dull roar, there's the cymbals. And it's just kind of like, okay, now where's my voice? Where's my guitar? You know, and where's one? That's what a singer has to know. Hopefully he knows the song and the changes and how he's going to breathe the whole way.
Obviously you're going out on this current tour armed with a new Homemade Sin record, and
yep.
It's really interesting because on the surface it sounds like the same Dan Baird and Homemade Sin that we've grown to know and love, but I do know that this one came together somewhat differently from a recording standpoint. I mean, and you guys...
Absolutely.
You guys weren't necessarily all in the same room when it came to recording all these songs.
Well, we were together on two songs.
Right.
Loud and Silver Little Lies, which we were able to record over in Sweden together.
Yep.
But I knew that we needed to be in the same room. I knew that Marl Magellan, our drummer, would not believe that Whacka Whacka had to happen in Get Loud that many times, that exact fill. You know, and it's 7-8 times in the song, you know, and drummers, you know, like if they do the same fill over and over again, they start feeling guilty or weird.
Right.
But it's like, no, man, that's the one that's needed. You know, it's as much a part of the song as, you know, as anything else. And Silver Little Lies, because of its dirgy quality, you know, the little eye contact goes a long way on that. And the rest of it, I would put together a demo of the song that had, you know, robot drums, a bass line, two guitars at least, and a vocal. Some of them were more fleshed out than that. And I would send all the files in Dropbox up to Wisconsin, where our drummer lives, and he would put on his drum parts and Dropbox them right back. And then I would send the, you know, same tracks over to our bassist in Sweden, and he would put his bass on and then bring him back here. And then me and Warner would sit down in the basement and figure out what the hell we needed to do to make it go. But since everybody basically uses, very few people get away with not using a quick track. So it's like, you know, if it's cut to a grid, it's cut to a grid. You know, it's the Nazi timekeeper. The trains will run on time, you know.
Right.
And that's the way most records are cut nowadays. You know, the drummer either has a quick feed or whatever. But it just keeps everybody in time, makes things go faster. And today, I don't see how... It's like, you know, I don't know how many records we sold, but let's say that, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 is our top zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, copies. You can't go rent a studio. You can't, you know, who's got time? You know, who can keep, you know, probably had the guy out in Sweden had a, you know, an old Studer 24 track. Yeah, we cut the first song to it. Second song, he burned up the power transformer.
Oh,
you
geez.
Know, it's like, and he had to wait for his guy, you know, it's like, you know, we had to swap over to Pro Tools, you know, and it was like, you know, it's like, who's got the guy that fixes all that crap? Nobody, you know, who aligns your tape machine now? Yeah. And getting everybody together in the same room would have been convenient, would have been preferable, but that we were supposed to do a tour of the U.S. last year, and we were going to do this on weekdays, you know, in wherever. Find us a studio. We'll go cut two songs, find, you know, travel along, find a studio, cut two songs. You know, Led Zeppelin 2 was made that way, you know, and just do it that way, you know, not get off course. Oh, the drum sounds are changing. Yeah. And the problem is, you know, but it's, instead, we did it, and Morrow kept on improving his drum sounds from Wisconsin, you know, changing his mic placement and stuff like that, and the guy that makes the thing, Joe, put his hair out, you know, and it's just like, well, he thinks he's getting better. You know, I don't send you these same exact amp settings on everything, because amps are easier.
Right.
Drums are harder. But I think that that's just going to be a wave of the future. You know, it is going to be every working musician worth his salt eventually. You know, if you're going to be, you know, what do you do for a living? I'm a musician. You know, that does something else. Okay, that's different. But if you're a musician, that's how you make your living. You're going to have a Pro Tools rig available to you, and you're going to, you know, rent space on Dropbox for $100 a year to be able to move huge files, and you're just going to just do it that way. You know, you're going to have, you know, a good mic, a decent mic pre, and Pro Tools. Bingo. You're done. You know? You could actually do it just, you know, with heavy. I think a bass player just, you know, has, I think, Pro Tools 7 or something like that, an ancient version. Doesn't matter. You know, it's just part of being a musician now. Especially if you want to record.
Yeah, and I think you're probably benefiting from the fact that you're making records with these guys that, you know, you guys have all made a good amount of records over the years.
Yeah.
But I wondered, like, for you, you know, how different is the, even though you've worked like this for a little bit of time now, like, how different does it feel? I mean, obviously at the core, you've still got a guy that's laying down drum tracks, a guy that's laying down bass tracks. You know, somebody's adding guitars here and there. You're putting on vocals. The pieces of the process sound like they're probably still familiar, but I wondered if it feels weird after so many years of making records the other way.
Well, it does have a cubist quality to it, which, you know, which direct, it used to be that you get together to get a drum track, right?
Right.
And then the bass player would come clean up his part, and the guitar players would, like, you know, is that a good enough rhythm guitar sound? I played the part fine. Oops, I played it like crap. I need to play it again. You know, the bass player usually, you know, it's like as soon as you decided, you know, yeah, that's completely keeper drum track. Are the guitars about right? Yeah, they're about right. Okay, I'll fix my bass up now, you know. And then you go to work on guitars and stuff later. But it's been done piecemeal. Whole cloth recording is where you cut, you know, every bit of the song together, like Tom Petty supposedly always did, you know, for years.
Right.
I don't know if he still does. But, you know, theoretically, they'd never splice from take to take. You know, it was like, nope, whole thing's got to be done head to take. I'd be like, wow. That's asking a lot out of five guys, you know. Nobody have one eye closed in a photograph, you know. One person, not hard. Five guys, hard. It's just different. The thing is, I moved to Nashville from Atlanta. In Atlanta, we spent a day getting drum sounds.
Sure, yeah.
Here they spend 30 minutes. Your engineer is knowledgeable. Your drummer better be knowledgeable. His gear better be in good shape. You know, you're not out looking for something. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, oh, all of this stuff is just pro. Learning curve, it's like usually second take. It's already happened. And so when I moved up here, my whole view of what you're supposed to do in the studio just altered completely. I went from the idea of a record taking 3 weeks to cut is like, man, if you're not done in a week, what are you doing?
Right. Yeah.
What are you doing? You should be done in 4 days cutting a dozen songs. And that's going in and scoping them. If everybody knows the tunes, you should cut side one in 1 day and side two the next day.
Yeah, and that was something that stuck out. I mean, it seemed like you guys were able to knock this record out pretty efficiently.
We actually did, and with me as kind of the ringmaster, which is just, if you knew me, that would, like, make you just laugh out loud.
Right.
I am... not quite, you know, Pigpen from the Peanuts comics, but not that far away either.
Yeah,
I'm kind of a ramshackle guy, and but it was like, okay, nobody else is going to do this. You got to do this. And up until mix, it was, you know, I was the guy. And I had no practical experience in mixing. I had enough practical experience in sticking a mic in front of a cabinet and moving it another inch or two this way or that way. And we built an isolation box, got a step-down transformer, an attenuator, and used big old amps and cut them real quiet. and work real hard.
Well, looking at this now as the, you know, third record that you guys, you know, have put out, mm-hmm. I mean, how does this one feel to you compared to where you guys were with the first two?
The first two, I think we had probably two or three songs on both records that possibly shouldn't have been there. They're kind of half-baked songs that we were hoping were better than they were. Mm-hmm. But with this one, we've found that we can go play all 11 songs live. There's nothing we wish we had back. Songs 9 and 10 are always songs 9 and 10, you know? When you go through, it's like you close with a good song. And it's, you know, I think I wrote by myself both. I know I wrote Get It Right by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one I wrote with Todd Snyder.
Little Bad Luck.
And that one, I think it got there just because it was kind of like there's a certain amount of plottingness to it that said it's just later in the record.
Yeah.
And some songs need to plod, you know? It's like every time I hear Get Loud, the recorded version, I go, man, we should have done that just a little quicker. And I start listening to it and go like, nah, man, that groove's mean. If we speed it up anymore, it doesn't get mean. Same thing on Don't Be Wasting My Time. I was going like, you know, if you sped it up a little bit, it'd be Nights of Mystery all over again.
Mm.
You know, don't do that. Leave it nice and slow and leave that, because that vocal was, all the vocals on that, I promise you, were guide vocals.
Oh, cool.
Some of them got, you know, some notes got tuned. Believe me, they were the ones that caught your sweater. And, you know, on your walk through the woods, a sycamore vine caught your sweater and just, you know, it's like, those aren't going to be there. But it wasn't a meticulous process. You know, if it makes you stop while you're listening to it, tune it. If it doesn't make you stop, let it go. And what's the song? Second song.
Oh, Nothing Left to Lose.
Yeah. That, you know, the second verse there, that's just not in tune, you know, but it sounds great. It just, you know, you can just hear me caterwauling. And it's like, it just sounds like rock. It's fine.
Yeah, that's one from what I know of it. I mean, that's the first song you guys worked on for the record. I mean, and that's one that just the vibe of that. I mean, you get that one in the bag, that has to feel pretty good and kind of stoke the flames for the rest of the record appropriately.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like it let us know that we could do.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, this is old guys trying young guy stuff. You know, to young guys, this is nothing. This is like, you know, the new standard operating procedure. The old guys, it's kind of like, well, we're not in a room. I'm the engineer. Oh, Jesus. You know, so we had, you know, a bunch of that kind of thing. And the learning process was pretty amazing. But it was always, you know, is that a convincing vocal? Is that a convincing rhythm section? Is that a convincing bunch of guitars? You know, are we all, you know, kind of, you know, coming together? And I sent a couple back tomorrow, our drummer, and said, you know, man, it's not right. I think it needs, you know, more aggressive. And he'd be like, I kind of liked it that way. And I went, Morrow, it needs to be more aggressive. Okay. And he sent me back what I needed. So actually, in a certain way, it was easier to do. Because you could take out your pencil and erase,
mm-hmm.
even, you know, the most foundational of things, which is drums, which is very nice. You know, imagine if you could build a house and stick the foundation in afterwards.
For sure. Oh, yeah.
But that's just the way, you know, things are.
Well, it's cool, too, because it seems like you used a hybrid. I mean, you talk about, like, you used a hybrid approach. You talk about, like, say, tuning a note if it needed it. But I know that there were other instances where, like, say, if Joe told you that the acoustic guitar, you know, didn't sound quite right, rather than going back to what you'd recorded and just trying to tweak that, it's like You just went and played it again, which is definitely the old school approach, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, you know, don't make him try and make it sound right. Go make it sound right.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, you know, the studio is in my basement. I've got it. It's always here. You know, it is. The only thing we have to do is just, you know, make sure the heater doesn't cut on.
Right.
Or the air conditioner, either one. You know, it's like if I'm doing vocals or acoustic guitars, the electric, that thing is in an ISO box. You could basically run a jackhammer outside and it wouldn't hear it.
And sequence wise, I mean,
they left it up to me.
Yeah.
They left it up to me. And I just, you know, I did go old school on that. I wrote, you know, the sheet of paper, you write out the name of every song, you get a pair of scissors, cut it out, and you start putting the puzzle together. You know, what do you want to open with? You know, what do you want to close with? What's midpoint? Now, shit, the instrumentals said midpoint. That basically turns the record into side one and side two. You know, is the instrumental the last song on side one or the first song on side two? I don't know. But it's one of the two.
And I think that's what was interesting, because I heard the instrumental and I was like, okay, that's got to be like probably the opening track on the second side of the vinyl version. But then I look and I see that you guys had some fun with the vinyl version and gave it different running order. And you split it into theme sides. So I kind of wondered, you know, how that came about.
That was just me being clever. or what passes for clever. What we do, we did the Malmo side, the rock side, the roll side, and the
country side. Yep.
Yeah. And it was just like, you know, we had three more country flavored numbers. We had, you know, the roll side was probably all blues based oriented stuff. The rock side was probably everything that had an edge to it. And the two Malmo songs came off, you know, on the Malmo side. And, you know, I remember showing it to Warner and I going, is this cool or am I being cute? And he goes, cute. so I went, cool, I'm doing it anyway.
That's awesome.
And and it was, you know, the funny thing was is when I divvied them up that way and started adding up time, I went, oh my god, they're all about the same amount of time.
Nice.
You know, within a minute or so. And I went, well, that'll be, you know, and I talked to Mick and I said, you know, is there any sense in doing a three-sided vinyl? Why don't we do it four-sided, you know, and do it this way? And he goes, may as well. So, you know, I am not a vinyl guy. I am not a vinyl guy. I want to come out and admit, you know, admit exactly what I am. I am a guy that, you know, it's like, wow, this is great. You know, my music comes out of my phone. It's, you know, I'm a man of convenience. You can't take it with you on tour. You can't take albums with you on tour, you know, and play them. You can take, you know, an MP3 and play it. They're easier to keep up with than CDs.
You talked about A Little Bad Luck, which you worked on with Todd Snyder. How did Todd get involved with that particular song?
He said he called me up one day or emailed me. Todd doesn't talk to much anybody. He emailed me and went, give me a title. I feel like writing. And I went, A Little Bad Luck. Goes a long way. And he goes, oh my God, perfect. Next morning, bam. Lyric was set out there and I went, okay, how does it move? You know? And sat there and just screwed around until my mouth kind of agreed with what I was doing. And Todd kept going, man, there's a way to make, you know, the chorus, you know, nice and long like you did the verses, you know, all the syllables get long. And I go, no, man, it stays this way. So there may be a Todd Snyder version eventually where, you know, there's the A Little Bad Luck. You know, he wanted to yank everything that direction, and I'm going, nah, that needs to be punchy. Because he was going, on the wrong side. side of town. You know, and I'm going, no, on the wrong side of town. You know, bark that out.
Right.
So it's like, you know, we wrote the song together, and it's my record. I'll do it the way I want it.
That's awesome.
And it was, you know, I thought we might need a third verse, and by the time we ended up, you know, I ended up mocking it up, I went, man, this is fine. This is absolutely fine.
That's probably cool to have that come into the process, just kind of have him drop into your world and, you know, right at the point when you kind of, you know, maybe needed another song.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like that one and a few of my own were the last two songs written. That one and finalizing what the what County Black was going to do. And, you know, when Warner came in with the, basically, I said, you know, here's you know, that's that part. And then I showed him the chords for the next part, but he came up with the bridge and the solo all by himself, and then thought of the theme for the G major part, which is, I guess, a chorus. I don't know. Yeah, instrumentals are weird. What's the chorus? It's not the verse. And that was really, really fun to do. I mean, if we had left all the guitars on there that we had actually put down, well, you'd never be able to hear anything. There's just so many guitars going on. But, you know, you'll hear every now and then I'm using the high string acoustic on the, you know, just for big flings on the da 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 da, ring, ring. And they're in there just slightly, as they should be. High strings should only be that loud.
And what
we had just a ton of fun just going back and forth, and I've learned how to play. He did the Luke Perkins part, and I've learned how to play that.
Nice.
That is that the pure discipline. Yeah. You think that's easy until you do it. It's like, and it's not the first three times through. It's like, you know, time 11 and 12 through that your brain just starts melting until you just get used to it.
And you talked about figuring out what that was going to be. I mean, was it the plan from the get-go to have it be an instrumental, or did you need to figure that part out?
Yes, I've wanted Warner to do an instrumental for ages.
Yeah.
He can sing, but he really finds his voice when he's playing guitar. That's when he brings everything he's got to bear on the situation. I can play solos, but I bring what I have to bear on the situation when I sing and play rhythm guitar. That's, you know, this is what I do. And so for him to have an instrumental was like, you know, I kept on bugging him to write one. I went, all right, I'll start it. You know, it goes like this. I don't want to sing over these chords.
Nice.
And so he was pretty much forced into, I pretty much backed him into a corner, and he came up with good.
Well, he has some good goods on this record. I mean, there's that song. I mean, and I love the riffs that you guys have on Thin Disguise as well.
Oh, that's a wonderful song to me. That one, I had 17 songs written by the time it was all said and done. And I told the guys, the three guys, I said, anybody wants to veto anything for any reason, please go right ahead. I'm going to make a record all by myself, and I'll use all of the leftovers for me. You know, it's not a problem. And I think I've finished the first round of recording. Now I've got drums on everything on that. And I'll just, you know, I'll start work on that in a bit. cool. When we get finished with this, I'll, you know, get that. So it'll be possibly in the wintertime it'll come out, or 2017, you know.
And so you're playing all the stuff on that one yourself?
Except the drums.
Nice.
Yeah, I got Brad Pemberton to play on those. So it doesn't sound exactly like Morrow, so it doesn't sound exactly like the same old thing. But, you know, everything done down in the basement once again, except for the drums, which was done over the ubiquitous Joe Blanton, who is now just a part of my life. He's also going to mix the record and sing all the backgrounds. I tried one song, me singing backgrounds with myself. It sounds so bad. It sounds so bad. It's just, it's awful. And it's just kind of like, okay, well, I'm not going to have a stick up my ass about singing my own backgrounds. You know, Joe sings it. You know, but I'm responsible for all the bass, the bad piano, the bad B3, all the solos. You know, that's all going to be me.
Well, you keep mentioning Joe. I mean, you've got to be enjoying what you've been doing with the Bluefields. I mean, you guys...
Love what we do with the Bluefields.
I mean, three albums in 3 years, you know? I mean, that's... And as I understand it, you know, you guys are kind of gazing at album number four. I mean, I guess for you,
We're talking about it. We're talking about it. Joe is... Now, he is a busy man now because late in life, he got a great job, and he's kind of shackled to that, but it's kind of like, oh, you know, it's kind of like, I do have to recognize that I need to make hay while the sun shines, and he's got a good paying job finally, and you know, as an audio visual guy, and he's got to kind of bow down to that, which he did not really. He wasn't involved with that when we were cutting all that Bluefield stuff. He had tons of free time.
Uh-huh.
Now his time is not so free, so I don't know whether we get more Bluefields or not. It's just depending. I hope we do, because I will be, you know, playing bass. You learn so much. You just learn so much. You learn what to quit playing as a guitar player. You know, it's kind of like, oh, clever. Wish he'd cut that the fuck out. You know, play the damn song.
Well, as you've kind of spoken to, it's probably nice to be able to hang back a bit and not be the quote-unquote main guy.
Well, it's like, believe me, if you see a Bluefields live show, you'll see Dan looking at his left hand, going like, "You sure you want to do that? I don't know. You know, you got to do something. I know. You know." But then that all happens in like a nanosecond, and then you know, and then repeat, and then repeat, and then repeat. You know, and it's just like, "Oh my God!" But at the end of the day, I come out a more knowledgeable musician, just simply because bass has to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to know what the beat is. It has to know what the chords are. It needs to know whether, you know, this is anticipatory. Is it back? You know, what do you do? Do you give the fact you're coming to a chorus away, you know, very obviously? Do you help the listener? Do you try and fool the listener? It's an amazing instrument. You know, when's the right time to go Phil Lesh, Jack Cassidy? What's the right time to go, you know, just down solid, simple? There's so many questions.
Does that channel its way in an interesting way back into, like, the stuff that you do musically for your other records? Do you see that having an interesting effect? Yeah.
Yes. It's you start writing a song and you go, the bass has to make this interesting because the chords themselves are not interesting. They're very predictable. In every song, you need something to make it interesting, whether it be the subject matter, whether it be the vocal line. The bass pattern oftentimes is the thing that really can kind of make things go. It's, if you listen to Silver Little Lies and you listen to Warner solo, and Mike's bass playing during that solo, he starts to do all this melodic stuff about halfway through, that it's just like, without that, all of a sudden Warner turns into Little Richard, you know, just screaming, you know, going crazy all by himself. And it's like, no, he needs a buddy, and the rhythm guitar and the drums cannot go with him. They just can't. And so it's up to the bass to do it. And that kind of thing is just really, really interesting. I'm glad I didn't have to figure out exactly where, when, and how. I found a couple of things when I was doing the demo where you could go, oh, I could play the third here instead of the root note and do like Danko did on Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. You know, it's he's not necessarily playing the tonic of the chord. And all that stuff's just unbelievably fascinating.
Well, and at the end of the day, I mean, you're in at least two bands with Warner Hodges, and that's probably something back in the 80s. I don't know if you could have imagined that.
No, not really. I mean, actually, and when Warner plays solo over here, I get one of the jobs. Usually it's playing bass.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be okay with it. And I keep on looking at him like, why don't you get a real guy that knows what the hell's going on this instrument? You know, it's bass playing. I'm going to take three times longer than a real bass player to come up with a good part. And it used to be five times longer. Now it's down to three times. I see I'm getting better. You know, at arriving at solutions. You know, bass playing is just, you know, what are the problems, you know, and what are the solutions? You know, and here you go, you're going to have to write your own solution. Rhythm guitar playing. Easy. Singing. Yeah, can you hit that note? Okay, then it's easy.
Well, what do you like, you know, looking at it from a homemade sin perspective, what do you like about being in a band with Warner and working with Warner?
He brings every night that it is available to him, in a live situation especially. No, and just his basic thing, he's got a fearlessness that is overwhelming. I mean, it is, he will, you know, it's like he will risk everything for a moment. It's just like, but he's so obvious about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, that is where music gets made. You know, we have some songs that do not have any wiggle room. They are what they are. Thin Disguise being one of them. You know, if you don't do that arrangement, we're going to get lost. Other songs, like Silver Little Lies, we can do what we want to. For a while, we're probably going to follow the prescribed map. But eventually, that thing's going to take off and move over someplace else, and something's going to happen to it. And it'll be, you know, I'm hoping it happens sooner than later, but the song does it all by itself.
Well, I guess looking at some other stuff, I mean, the Yahoos did their thing for a number of years, then things get kind of quiet. I mean, it's been about 10 years since that last record, and I wondered kind of what happened there that train kind of stopped moving forward.
A number of individual things that had to do with between band members, which makes it impossible for me to talk about.
Yeah.
And that got it derailed for a little while, and then everybody got busy doing stuff, and the Yahoos were designed to be everybody's second band. And complex scheduling, et cetera, et cetera. Not saying that we'll never work together again. That's not the case. You know, I'm hoping that we can sometime. Got a few things got to fix.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I have to be that noncommittal about it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it was kind of an important moment, though, the formation of that band, because it seems like it does kind of sort of lay the groundwork in a way for how you would approach making music going forward, because, like, I look at, you could easily be somebody that puts together a solo group and just goes out and plays your tunes from different eras, and you've certainly done that, but it seems like it's a lot more exciting creatively the way you did it with that and the way you've done it with Homemade Sin for both sides, the artists and the fans, to take kind of a more rock and roll stew approach, bring a bunch of guys together and see what develops.
Well, this is the mainstay of the thing. You know, if you're going to ask me to sing, it's going to have a certain persona. If you ask me to play rhythm guitar, it's going to have a certain persona.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little more flexible on things I'm not as good at. But the other things is kind of, I think I'm right.
Right.
And... and instinctually, you know, the Yahoos, it's just kind of like you just ask everybody to come up and do their best on whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember the first record, you know, Terry had a hell of a time getting the drum part down to Get Right With Jesus, and until I said, just play it like Jerry Shirley. And he went, oh. And so the switch just hit. He just went, right, rocking the Fillmore. Here we go. And, you know, and that's his take on that. And, you know, and I would have trouble playing a guitar part on Monkey, Who Gave the Monkey a Gun. And it would be like, you know, Eric would, you know, give me some name, you know, drop some, oh, channel that guy. Got it. And, you know, it was, that's just kind of the way that whole thing came together. And that first record was really, really fun to make because we weren't making a record. We were making some demos. And we decided, what the hell? We know how to make demos. Let's go out and write songs. And we wrote and recorded the thing in a week, you know, which fast burn is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Musicians bore easily, which is why I like that. When I moved to Nashville, I went, oh, 30 minutes on drum sounds. This is better. You know, 5 minutes on bass sound, 5 minutes for each guitar, you know, tops. Hopefully turn on the mic, adjust the compressor, adjust the mic pre. Let's go. You know, maybe move the mic once.
And it's always interesting to, you know, hear somebody like you kind of talk about the creative struggles that you encounter making a record like that, because it's like you make a type of music that, like, it sounds like, you know, to the uninitiated, it sounds like something that might have fallen together really easily in the studio. So I think it's kind of, it humanizes it a little bit for people to know that, like, you guys, you know, go up against the wall with certain things like everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that the creative process, you're always going to find a low bridge here and there. You're always going to find something that tricks you. But it is, you know, where does it come in? Well, you know, in the studio, it's always, you know, I've written a bunch of songs. Here, drummer, here's the songs. Oh, how does this move into that? You know, and Marl Magellan's a guy that needs to sit back and listen to it and think about how he's going to turn the corner from verse into chorus, from chorus into the turn, into the back into the verse. You know, it's always the corners that he has to work with. And it usually takes him a while. Well, he's got all the time in the world when he's doing them at his house.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and it's kind of like, you know, and the guitar part isn't constantly morphing on him. It's the same one he's been playing to. you know, it's all the creative stuff. You know, the problems pop up in different areas, and it's always playing whack-a-mole.
Right.
You know, you just try. You know, who's the problem? You're going to get your head smashed down. You know, and it's really easy this way if everybody, you know, has a rig and knows how to run their instrument into their rig. Of course, that's another level of learning. But it's like, you know, I already had a drummer with Pro Tools already. I had a bass player with Pro Tools already. I got mine. It was almost a year ago that I got the rig. So I've already cut two records on it. You know, maybe more. Hopefully more.
Well, it's been awesome to see, because there was that time after, like, say, Buffalo Nickel, where things got a little bit quiet for you recording-wise, and it's just been nice the past 10, 15 years to see how you've been able to, you know, bust out a lot of different records.
Yeah. Well, I had to have the right crew, and Warner got on board, and it was the right crew.
Yeah.
And that has just made a... He's kind of got that middle linebacker mentality, and it's, you know, this is going to happen. This is going to make this fucking happen, you know. Jack Lambert, you know, just and so that part of things has been really good and really positive.
Well, looking at wrapping up, besides, you know, the new record that you mentioned that you're working on and this, you know, this tour that's on deck, what else is kind of on your slate for the year?
We've got a bunch of shows over in Europe. Like I say, you know, putting the polish on my record. And then the thing that I don't want to do is quit writing songs. That is, from that everything springs.
For sure.
Yeah, the songs are the most valuable commodity there are.
And it seems like you've been in a really good place doing that, particularly like the past year or so. It sounds like, you know, getting that Pro Tools rig really kind of juiced your songwriting.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it's like, you know, I've written a bunch of songs that don't fit my voice, but they'll show up somewhere. You know, I've probably got about 10 of those.
Cool.
That, you know, they're good songs, but they don't suit my voice. Couple of them, Bluefields. Couple of them I've written with a guy, David Newbold. He's Canadian. He lives here. But he sings them much better than I do, but I don't know if he wants to do it. They'll end up somewhere. They'll find a home. And, you know, but it's just, you know, continuing to write. That's the one thing that you cannot have. You know, I have too many songs. I have too much money.
Hey, it's a good place to be, man. You know, to still have that fire. You know, I mean, there are folks that are your age that don't have that fire.
Yeah. The hardest thing is to find stuff to write about, which is why there's a bunch of co-writes. You know, it's like, yeah, I know how it moves. I know what the is supposed to do, but I don't know necessarily what it's about. And a lot of times you have another guy come in and go, oh, it's obviously about that. And then you start writing.
Did it take you a while to kind of like open your songwriting process up to let those other people in?
Trying to think. No, I started out a collaborator. I wouldn't write lyrics at all. And one of the first songs I wrote lyric for was Keep Your Hands.
Hmm.
So I started to trust that a little bit. And usually the only song that I think that I had for years that I had all the music to, I knew how it moved, I knew what the vocal was going to do, was Younger Face. And I had the music for that for 4 years, and I went, you're not farming this out to anybody, you're writing it yourself. And then, so it took four years and 15 minutes. You know, first line came to me, and the rest of it just, bleh, you know, keeps itself out.
Well, awesome, man. Well, thank you for the time on this, and you know,
Matt, not a problem, my friend. And well, I hope to be seeing you up there in Ohio, up by the river.
You absolutely will. I've had some snowy evenings with Dan Baird and Yahoos and otherwise at the Beachland, so it's good to have you guys back there for another run.
Well, I'm sure there'll be snow.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, all have right, a good amigo. Day. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, I'll
take
see
care
you.
Of yourself.
You too. Bye.